The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to analyze, talk about, and President Obama's speech today at the United Nations he made this morning, and foreign policy, clearly one of the big issues in this presidential election. He said a great deal, and we have two men with us. Dr. Adil Shamu is with us. He is professor at the University of Maryland, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus, and Michael Rubin is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, senior lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School Center for Civil Military Relations, and senior editor at Middle East Quarterly. And Adil and Michael, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just start. Michael, let me begin with you. And again, I appreciate realizing that you are overseas, staying up with us today. It means a great deal to us. So I thank you very much for that. Talk first about your overall analysis, impression of President Barack Obama's speech, and how do you think it carried in terms of its weight on foreign policy?
Well, my overall impression of the speech is actually very, very positive. I think that President Obama hit the major point which I was hoping he would make, which is a defense of free speech. The idea of free speech and its role has come into conflict with the idea of religious sensibilities and how they should be protected. We have the Arab League, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and the government of Turkey all pushing on an international stage to outlaw criticism of Islam and caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. And while those, such criticism or belittling of religion is certainly hurtful toward Muslims, there's a real question about whether that should just ever justify violence. And I think President Obama really hit that nail on the head.
Adil, your analysis of what you heard overall.
Well, in general, it was somewhat positive, but I think he was speaking to three audiences, and that's why he had difficulty really putting them all together, the international community, the Middle East, and, of course, the voters in the United States. And that's so the best way is to wrap it in the senseless killing of our ambassador. More importantly, he spoke about the four issues, Syria, Iran, Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and somewhat a little bit about the Saudi Arabia Gulf state by not mentioning them. in terms of, to me, the most dangerous point, we may come back to it, he's really hardening his position because of various things we will, again, may talk about them, about the Iran nuclear weapons.
There's been a lot of criticism of President Barack Obama's foreign policy, saying that he can't control what's happening overseas. The Middle East has kind of taken on dimensions in the Arab Spring, and that taking on, like as example, somebody posited the other day, taking on Mubarak and pushing him out may have opened up democracy, but it led to floodgates that cannot be controlled. So, and I think, do either one of you think that any American president can really control that? I mean, and let's just start with that. Michael?
Well, if I could jump in, I know in hindsight it's very easy to say that we should have stuck with Hosni Mubarak, but I do think it's somewhat ridiculous, this idea that we should ever base U.S. national security on aging, sick, octogenarian dictators. arguably, we could talk about, in the words, or to paraphrase the Egyptian sociologist Saadeddine Ibrahim, if we have this dichotomy between autocrats and theocrats, who actually tend often to be mirror images of one another, how do we create some sort of third way, some sort of space for the liberals in between? Here's where I can get into a little bit of criticism with regard to President Obama. I mean, first of all, when it came to the Middle East, not only in Egypt, but in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere, to me, sometimes he seems like a gambler who wants to see all the cards before he places his bets. And what that does is it creates a lot of distrust on both sides because everyone sees the United States sort of sitting on the sidelines, and they take a very cynical view towards that. when it comes to the actual speech of President Obama, while he did go beyond the trap we got into during the Bush administration, which was defining democracy just in terms of elections, I do believe that he could have talked about this idea of freedom of speech beyond just the context of the United States and instead talk about how it really is what's necessary for democracy to thrive. And he could have taken the opportunity to define other aspects of democracy and to push for them. But generally speaking, my main criticism of U.S. foreign policy, and it applies both towards Democrats and Republicans, is too often we tend to be reactive rather than proactive. I can't remember the last time we really had a coherent strategy in the region.
Adil?
Well, I agree with Michael on a great deal of what he said. But the trouble is that the United States is shaking itself in a transition period from supporting those octogenarians, dictators in the Middle East, to democratically elected leaders. And we are having trouble with that. First, we never recognize that we really, the Middle Eastern countries and people had a reason why they didn't like our policy. It's not because they don't love our freedom. This is such a nonsense conversation, and I hear it from important people. You know, even these, some of these anchors of 24-hour channels. It's that transition, and Obama tries, really is trying, and this is where I give him some credit, trying, but he's so fearful of the pro-Israeli lobby, he's so fearful of the election, he's so fearful of the Republicans, that he takes one step forward and about step and a half back, and he ends up in the same place.
So you know, I was interested in what you said a moment ago, Michael, when you said you have not seen from either Republicans or Democrats a coherent policy on the Middle East. And I'd like to start with you, since you raised it. I'd like to hear what you mean, how you would define that, and I'd like to hear how Adil would define a coherent policy.
Well, I mean, in short, it seems that often in the Middle East, we tend to be reacting to events rather than trying to determine where we would like to see the region 2 or 5 or 10 years from now, and then walking the cat backwards to figure out how we should get there. One of the major problems we had, and we certainly had this during the Bush administration, and actually when it comes to the discrepancy or the dichotomy between how President Obama has acted towards Libya, how President Obama and his administration have acted towards Syria, there's a real problem when a gap develops, a wide gap develops, between the rhetoric of American policymakers and the reality of that policy. And this can be dangerous in two ways. Certainly, if a gap between our rhetoric and the reality of our policy develops, it creates a lot of cynicism. I mean, people are right to ask, well, why did we intervene in Libya, supposedly for humanitarian reasons, and yet we stand aside more or less when it comes to similar things going on in Syria? The other dangerous point here is that if we allow this gap to develop between our rhetoric and what our policy actually is, it creates a lot of confusion about what the red lines are that the Americans are going to hold firm to in the Middle East. And this, in turn, can create space for misunderstanding, and we could find ourselves, as a result, slipping into a conflict which we didn't intend to happen.
Adil, how would that fit for you? What does a coherent policy mean for you?
Well, again, we are in a transition, and we're trying to do it with the old principles. When we do interventions are unprincipled, we bring our goons there and our thugs to run the country, like we tried to do in Iraq in an invasion. In Libya, we brought the expats who have no roots in the country, and we put them in power, the Western country, France and Britain. So we mix in good intentions with unprincipled interventions, and then we end up not supporting the liberty in Bahrain, but we support it in Syria. And we are supporting it in Syria, but we say nothing about the hundreds of millions of dollars the Saudis are giving weapons to these opposition fighters, whom a large number of them, they will slaughter all the Christians in Syria as well as the Alawiyat. And that is the chaos we see. And Obama, I feel sympathy for him because I have a feeling he wants to do the right thing, but the right thing will never happen within 4 or 8 years of his presidency, and he knows that transition is going to take a decade or two. And that's the direction I want to see, honest, open, principled intervention when we have to, whether it's humanitarian or not. Say to the world, what are our guidelines, what are our principles, and why we don't interfere in Bahrain? Well, because we have 15,000 Navy personnel in Bahrain. Why don't we oppose, for example, all the thuggery is buying out by the Saudi hundreds of millions of dollars? Because we need their oil. But that's not going to continue as our policy. Maybe in 5 years, maybe 10 years, we are changing slowly, and we are going to be able to support 100%. Now we may support them 50%. Freedom and democracy and true democracy, not the elections happen in Iraq with a blue thumb. That was not a democracy, but rather a show for American media.
Well, so let's examine some of this. I mean, can America's policy, something you said, Michael, that there's a couple of areas I want to make sure we explore, including Iran and Israel-Palestine and what President Obama said and didn't say. But when you talked about a coherent policy and you talk about where we would like, we being the United States, would like to see the region 10, 20 years from now, is that a problem in itself? Is that part of the problem? Some people would argue that American policy and Western policy has had all along, which is trying to design a region in our interest as opposed to, well, you said, maybe in a negative sense, being more reactive to or being in tune with as opposed to trying to design it.
Well, I'd say it's really navel-gazing to assume that we are trying to influence the region, and if it weren't for us, then it would be an even playing field. In reality, when we are being reactive, if we choose to take a more isolationist line, sit on the sidelines, then what we get are some of the more hardline elements in the region, whether they're the Saudis or the Qataris with the money which supports many of the more extreme Salafi elements, or whether they're the Iranians who are supporting some of the worst elements in Syria and Lebanon. What we tend to do when we don't support those who perhaps share our values, who take a more liberal approach to the region, is we're really disadvantaging them. That's why I said, and again, paraphrasing the Egyptian-American sociologist Saadeddine Ibrahim, in the region you have autocrats who have always used the mechanisms of state, the ministries, the state television, and so forth, to promote their power. You have the theocrats who have used the mosque. And actually, they recruit off each other. They're mirror images of each other. But their common enemy, when one develops, are those liberals who want to have the ones who actually initially came out on the street in Tunisia and Cairo and so forth.
Dill?
Well, let's take a recent case of President Morsi of Egypt. Freely elected, fair and fair election. He won an election. And instead of just supporting him, we are watching every step of the way. Is he friend or foe? And we are all American-centric or Israeli-centric. We say, if he keeps peace with Israel and honors the treaty, well, he answered them. He said, I will honor the treaty when you guys honor what you said in the treaty, and that is there will be already a self-governed, independent state for Palestinians. That hasn't happened. And these are the kind of questions we need really to face. Middle Eastern people are not stupid, and they are capable of understanding hypocrisy when they see it right in front of them. In the case even with Iran, and I'm not really a supporter, I'm an anti-nuclear weapons, but the hypocrisy, they see Israel having over 200 nuclear weapons. They want to have a nuclear weapon, okay? We say, you can't have it. Well, by what logic we determine that one country can have it and another country doesn't have it? India has it, Pakistan has it, China, Russia, United States, England, France, and you could go on and on. Sooner or later, some of these countries are going to get a nuclear weapon. Worst come to worst, they'll buy it with a few billion dollars. And that's the kind of sort of contradictory policy we have. The Middle East have lived with that for 70 years. I was yesterday in a dinner with a group of Iraqi just came from Baghdad. And I was saying, unfortunately, the invasion has taken back Iraq 30 years. They said, no, 300 years. That's how mad and upset they were. Iraq has been totally destroyed in our invasion. And no one in this country in the news and channels and everybody talks about 200,000-300,000 Iraqi deaths. We only talk about our losses of 5,000. And that, to me, it shows really such a discriminatory mentality towards other nations and their people.
Michael, I'd like you to respond. Are your thoughts the same or different?
I mean, certainly I could quibble with a lot of Adel's statements of facts. I mean, there's a difference between the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty being a signatory to that and not being a signatory to that. There's, as former Prime Minister Howard of Australia has pointed out, and as the former Justice Minister in Canada has pointed out, there are enshrined in international law, based on the experience in Rwanda back in 1994, clear mechanisms that indicate incitement to genocide, and it seems that the confluence of Iran's nuclear ambitions with some of the statements coming from the Supreme Leader, coming from President Ahmadinejad, coming from former President Rafsanjani and so forth has created a great deal of international concern. But more broadly, when we look at the region, one big issue comes out. Yes, there needs to be a solution to the Israel-Palestine situation, a two-state solution where people live side by side. And the Americans, since Bill Clinton on, have made a good faith effort to try to get that into play. There's a real problem there, real disagreements between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and they have to be hashed out diplomatically. That's not a reason to scrap the Camp David Accords, or when it comes to the nuclear question, which Adil was talking about, scrap the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and just allow proliferation across the region. More broadly, however, in the Middle East, one refreshing aspect of the Arab Spring and some of the internal Arabic discussion about what democracy is for once it doesn't only revolve around the Arab-Israeli situation. For too long, dictators in the region, whether it was Saddam Hussein, Bashar al-Assad, Hosni Mubarak, and others, have tried to deflect attention away from the necessary internal reforms and government accountability, using the Palestinian-Israeli situation as an excuse. Both need to be solved, but we shouldn't ever allow a situation of no accountability. And the last thing, and it was the first thing Adil mentioned, was we should, I mean, this idea of just supporting Mohamed Morsi because he won the election. Remember, there's a big question about Parliament, and I would say, just as an American citizen, that U.S. foreign aid should never simply be used as an entitlement to a regime that might not uphold the treaty alliances or might take other hostile actions, such as not protecting the U.S. embassy.
Adil?
Well, I don't quibble with the correction about the NTP, the non-proliferation, NPT, the non-proliferation treaty, but all it takes to get out of the membership, because India and Israel are not members, so that means they could have any number of nuclear weapons. The logic of that escaped me as someone who dabbles with philosophy. It just makes no sense to me. There are conditions by which they could get out of the non-proliferation treaty, and then you will say it's okay for them to have a nuclear weapon? Of course not. Obama changed his view under pressure from Israel from containment, and a lot of people have written about containment, that it is a viable solution, into now what we have said, no, you will not have a nuclear weapon. And what my fear is, within 6 months at most, we're going to have a war with Iran. Does this country want to have another war in Middle East? Do you really want them to have a war with Iran? I mean, I'm asking Michael. How would you get around not having a war with Iran? That's really what we're facing within 6 months.
I was going to come to that question myself, to both of you, about what our next step should be around Iran and from what the president said. Michael?
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, I'm very much on the record opposing military strikes on Iran because they would simply delay the issue of Iran's nuclear program and kick the can down the road. Ultimately, what I think we should be doing is, I mean, what the United States and Europe should be doing would be to promote the ability and empower people inside Iran to make the regime much more accountable to the ordinary Iranian people, because the Iranians are far more moderate than their regime. Whenever I go to Europe and I talk to Green Party members, for example, or Social Democrats, I always berate them on why they don't do more to support Iran's independent trade unions. Throughout the Middle East, oftentimes in the United States, we talk about non-governmental organizations. In reality, throughout the Middle East, you have GONGOs, government-operated non-governmental organizations. But starting in 2005, you really had sort of a L'Equivalenza Gdansk moment in Iran when Iranians on their own, before the Green Movement, started forming their own independent trade unions. I think that could be the basis of a real U.S. strategy to try to bring accountability to Iran. But much more, I mean, in an answer to Adil's question, two quick points. When you do agree to be a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, you get certain benefits in terms of technology, trade, and so forth. And so Iran joined the NPT because they wanted to get those benefits. The other issue with regard to containment, the reason why many people don't believe containment will work, and what the nightmare scenario is this, and it means a lot to me sitting here in Romania, because you had a situation like that here. Now, in Iran, you have a situation where we oftentimes talk in the West about hardliners versus reformers in the Iranian political spectrum. But what remains a big black hole are the political factionalizations within the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Now, if Iran develops a nuclear weapon, it would be the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which has to have command, control, and custody of it. And certainly, the IRGC isn't a monolith, but the most radical, ideologically pure faction would likely have control of this weapon. Now, if you have a situation like in 2009 when you have an uprising in Iran, but this time the security forces join in, so the regime realizes it only has a couple hours left. In a situation like that, if you have ideologues in charge of the weapon, they may launch figuring, heck, the regime's not suicidal, but we're dead anyway, so we might as well. And in a situation like that, there really is nothing you can do. It's not like the United States or Israel would retaliate against the country, kill 20 million Iranians that already had regime change. And so the idea of mutually assured destruction that persisted throughout the Cold War might not necessarily apply when we have an ideological regime.
Well,
like
as you
Iran.
Know, Ken Walzer have refuted the Mad Mullah hypothesis. And as a matter of fact, I was reading an Iranian journalist who lives in the West. He said when he goes to Tehran and he even interviews those prisoners or these opposition leaders or journalists who hates Ahmadinejad's regime, they say if we are attacked because of nuclear weapons, we will all, and he thinks 95% of Iranians will support their own government.
No, I there's absolutely nothing wrong with supporting labor unions in Iran. Some people will say, if you give money, and I'm not saying that we should necessarily be giving money, it's just going to taint the civil society as being foreign agents. But when you look at the Iranian rhetoric, you have them accused of that anyway, so it's sort of damned if we do, damned if we don't. We might as well do what we think is right. But more importantly, in your discussion, and look, I've gone back and forth to Iran, although they won't give me, in recent years, they haven't given me a visa. The one point that remains is while the Iranian people are lovely, and Iranian politicians are smart and adept and cosmopolitan and all that, we still don't know what occurs within the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. It remains essentially a big black box, and that is very dangerous.
Look, I'm in no position and in no way from my background I'm supporting Ahmadinejad regime or the thuggery he commits against his own people. So I'm not defending it. What I'm proposing is that we try to avoid war, and the rhetoric has been hardened by lobbying Obama administration, by what I call it, the neocons and other groups, other conservative groups, which are bringing this country to the brink of another major war. And we just finished one, and on the other one, we're still mired in it, and there is really no light in the end of the tunnel, even though they claim in 2 years they're going to be out.
That's a bit conspiratorial, I'd say, only because it's been a consistent policy of the United States during the Clinton administration, during the Bush administration, and on up, And certainly it doesn't seem to be just whatever you call neocons. I mean, people define them in different ways, or conservatives, but many liberals, many progressives, many gays, many Baha'is, many others would agree that there's a real problem in Iran. And while I agree with you that the Iranian people would rally around the flag in case of a military strike, which is one of the reasons why I oppose a military strike on Iran, that doesn't mean we shouldn't have a discussion about how to change the situation in Iran. But going back to President Obama's speech, one thing which worries me a great deal, and this lies in the animosity which is clearly developed between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, is it reminds me of what happened with, if I can put on my history cap, my nerd cap, and go back more than 50 years, Dean Acheson was Harry Truman's Secretary of State. In January 1950, he gave a statement about what the United States defense perimeters would be, what our interests would be in defending, and by omission, what our interests wouldn't be in defending. He talked about creating a defensive perimeter from the Ryukyu Islands to Japan to the Philippines. He left out Korea, and it was that omission which convinced the North Korean leader that maybe he could just get away with invading South Korea. Now, if President Obama's antipathy towards the Israelis continues in public, what I'm afraid is that there could be a significant miscalculation on the Iranians' part, thinking literally perhaps that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and Khamenei's regime could get away with murder.
I don't agree with that interpretation. That is so convenient interpretation to support the pro-Israeli desires to go and attack Iran because that's really what they want. They want to engulf. The Israelis have no interest in doing it by themselves. They want to drag with them the United States because they know they are not as effective and they will not be able to really harm great deal the nuclear facilities in Iran, and their refueling problems will be tremendous. And that's really their goal. I am very disturbed that conservatives do not oppose a foreign nation like Israel, even though it's our strongest ally, is basically telling the president of the United States, you got to go and attack Iran. That's really what boils down to it.
So,
and they take advantage, excuse me for a minute.
But we're just running out of time.
Of the election. And this is no different than in January 08, the Israeli attacked Gaza just before Obama was inaugurated because they knew they'll get away, and that's why they killed 1,500 Palestinians. 300 of them were children, wounded 5,000, and the Israeli only lost 12, which means that was not a war, that was a slaughter of human beings.
So I'm afraid we are out of time, but this has been a fascinating and lively and really informative conversation. I want to thank Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies, contributor to Foreign Policy and Focus, Dr. Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and senior editor of Middle East Quarterly, for joining us. It's great to have you both on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-638-7781.